323-0331, the people of the state of Illinois, appellee by Justin Nicolosi versus Martez L. Moore, appellant by Ann Brenner.
Ms. Brenner, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Ann Brenner. I'm with the Office of the State Appellate Defender here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Martez Moore. Mr. Moore asserts that his counsel was ineffective in this case for failing to properly challenge the state's evidence that his blood alcohol content was 0.171 on the date of a fatal motor vehicle accident in which he was involved. This was the only evidence the state had to support the conviction for aggravated driving under the influence, death of another. Furthermore, the motion would have been granted under Illinois state law had it been filed.
Obviously, we're familiar with the facts, so let's just go to that. Mm-hmm. I presume you would agree that if Mr. Moore actually consented, there would be no basis for the motion and it wouldn't succeed. Would you agree with that basic principle? Not that it happened, but...
Absolutely, yes.
Okay,
if he had consented, it would be constitutional.
So what facts in the record do you rely upon to conclude he did not consent?
Well, the fact that the trooper warned him, gave him the warning to motorists, which is an Illinois State Police form, one of two forms, both of which comply with the statute, 625 ILCS 511-501. There are two sections of that statute, which are commonly referred to as the implied consent statutes. And those are section 501.1 and 501.6. 501.1 concerns driving under the influence, where a chemical test, a sample for chemical testing may be solicited by law enforcement only after they have established probable cause, which is evidenced by the issuance of a uniform traffic ticket, in that case for driving under the influence. So they've established probable cause of DUI. Under 501.6, on the other hand, the second of two implied consent statutes, that involves a fatal or type A injury, which is a very serious injury, motor vehicle accident, where the driver is found to have violated any non-equipment violation of the Illinois Vehicle Code. And again, just as in the first implied consent statute, probable cause must be established, and that's evidenced by the issuance of that ticket, the uniform traffic ticket. In this case, the warning was given, but a ticket was not issued, and Mr. Moore had not been arrested at the time of the warning. So you have a question?
Well, this isn't a statutory summary suspension case, right? So,
correct.
I mean, this is a question of whether there was a basis to suppress the blood result.
Correct.
What is it? Well, let me ask you this. How do we know which portion? It could be all. We have no shortage of cases where the officer or the trooper screws it up and doesn't read the whole thing. I mean, do we have any idea what, assuming that it was the DUI warning to motorists that was read, because I think that was the testimony. Assuming that that's the one that was read, I mean, we have no idea which part of it was read, how much of it was read. We're just guessing in respects.
That's correct, Justice Brennan. We don't know the specific details of what was read, when that warning was read. What we have is Trooper Quick's testimony that he issued the warning. When asked to describe the warning, his testimony was that it is the warning that we give to individuals we believe to have been to be under the influence of alcohol or a drug at the time. He said he gave the warning, so it's implied that he gave the entire warning. But at the very outset of the warning, regardless, if he started to read the warning, the very first thing that he would have read was that you have been arrested for driving under the influence. And as a result of that arrest, which has to be based on probable cause, you have impliedly consented under Illinois state law to giving your blood or your urine for chemical testing. And then the warning follows up with a bit of a threat where if you consent to the testing and you're found and it comes back positive for either alcohol or drugs, you will automatically lose your license for a certain amount of time. But if you refuse the testing, having impliedly consented, you will lose your license for even greater amount of time. I think it's a minimum of 1 to 3 years. 1 year if this is your first offense, 3 years if it's your second or third offense, and then going up from there. Those are the minimums. So our argument is that the consent was coerced because of that specific warning, because he was essentially threatened with the loss of his license and for a greater period of time because he had impliedly consented by virtue of driving on Illinois roads, breaking the law, in this case being involved in a fatal motor vehicle accident. But when the warning was given, Trooper Quick did not actually have probable cause, and that would have been evidence if he did. It would be in the record, a uniform traffic ticket.
Does the warning to motorists actually use the language "you have impliedly consented"?
I don't believe that specifically.
That's an interpretation. I mean, that's our understanding of why we have it in the first place, but that's not in the warning to motorists.
Correct. It's not in the warnings to motorists. It's in the statutes, however, or it's at least in the case law that discusses the statutes.
Right. But again, we're talking about consent.
Right. So,
and you're saying that the warning to motorists somehow vitiated the consent, what otherwise would have been consent potentially.
Correct.
So what is it specifically that vitiates or makes any consent involuntary?
Well, it's the coercive measure of the threat that you will lose your license for a greater amount of time if you do not agree to give your sample, because you have implicitly agreed to give it by virtue of driving on our roads and committing an offense, whether it's DUI or any non-equipment violation, and coupled with being involved in the fatal MVA.
At the time of the request of Mr. Moore to provide the blood sample, was there probable cause to arrest him for DUI?
There was not. There was not, because when Trooper Quick arrived on the scene of the two-vehicle accident, he first approached a white vehicle, which he identified the driver of as my client, Mr. Martez Moore, in court. Mr. Moore was unconscious. He was trapped in the driver's seat of the vehicle, and he had paramedics surrounding him trying to extricate him from the vehicle. So there was no contact between Trooper Quick and Mr. Moore on the scene of the accident.
Was there probable cause to issue a traffic ticket?
There was not, no. And in fact, that was specifically asked about on cross-examination, because the defense counsel did inquire as to why the other driver was ticketed and Mr. Moore was not. And so Trooper Quick was explicit that at the time that he issued the traffic ticket to the other driver for failing to yield the stop sign, he had no knowledge of Mr. Moore's speed at the time of the crash.
When was the independent witness that talked about Mr. Moore's car passing his car at a high rate of speed, when was that discussion had with someone from law enforcement? Was it at the scene?
It was at the scene, but it would have been with different deputies.
Well, isn't there this collective knowledge doctrine, this idea that what's said to one officer is said to all officers for purposes of probable cause?
There's a potential for that, but that is not explicit from the record. And very clearly, Trooper Quick said that he gave the warning because he believed Mr. Moore to be under the influence of alcohol and drugs, not because he believed him to have been speeding at the time of the crash. And speed alone does not mean that you are under the influence, or quite a few people on our roads would be picking up DUIs.
And there's nothing in the record that would support the suggestion that Trooper Quick was aware of the hospital blood results at the time he read the warning to motorists. Is that correct?
Correct. That is correct. The individual, the nurse who did the blood draw did not testify at trial. The parties agreed to stipulation that she did the blood draw in compliance with state law. But there's no indication, though, that it was a medical, that any party from the treatment team reached out to law enforcement and said, you know, he's clearly inebriated.
And just, I want to just make sure I'm correct in this. I mean, we all know sitting here that there presumably was a hospital blood because they'd have to do one given his injuries, and we probably do have an alcohol number in that CBC or whatever, but there's absolutely no evidence of whatever that was in the record, correct?
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And just back to the point of the warning being coercive, I just want to refer you to an Illinois State Supreme Court, case, People v. Cazaza, which says where law enforcement falsely informs a citizen that they have the lawful authority to search and they, in fact, do not have that lawful authority, that search is unconstitutional. Again, that's Cazaza, C-A-S-A-Z-Z-A.
In People versus Harris, the wrong notice was read, and there was a suggestion that that was not coercive. Why might we not find that line of cases compelling?
Well, for our purposes, the difference between the two notices, the two warnings, it's a distinction without a difference, because both of them, at the very outset, state that you have either been arrested for driving under the influence or you are at fault for a fatal motor vehicle accident or a motor vehicle accident involving a type A injury as evidenced by the issuance of a uniform traffic ticket. So regardless of which warning was given, the outcome for your analysis as far as we are concerned is the same. The state does point to Patel, which had a similar holding to Harris, but in that case, the facts were quite a bit distinguishable from our present case. The trooper in Patel did establish probable cause in that it was overheard. First of all, the driver rear-ended someone who was stopped at the stop sign, so it was clearly a red light, so it was clearly the driver's fault. The officer overheard the driver saying to the paramedic on the scene that he had something to drink as well as some kind of drug prior to driving that night. Then the officer went to his hospital bed, as did Trooper Quick here, but instead of just straight up giving him the warning, he initiated field sobriety tests, which defendant Patel failed. And then he gave him a breathalyzer, all of which are fine, all of which are legal without, you know, that's the process of establishing probable cause. Those are all fine, but it's the line that Trooper Quick crossed, which is giving that warning that we are arguing is a coercive measure because it threatens the individual warned with the loss of their driver's license for a greater period of time should they refuse, because they have, under our law, impliedly consented by virtue of breaking the law. And that was not done in this case because while the record, and I do understand your point, Justice Brennan, that the record is minimal and it's tough for a reviewing court when you're reviewing whether counsel was ineffective for not filing a motion to suppress, because the state didn't have an opportunity to respond to that in the court below. But here, the critical piece of evidence that would have been introduced is that uniform traffic ticket. And we can say quite clearly there was no traffic ticket written. So if
one was written at some point though, right?
Not to Mr. Moore, not by Trooper Quick, no. The actual investigation into the entire accident was done by two different individuals.
Ultimately, did Mr. Moore not receive some kind of a traffic ticket related to this case that was then dismissed?
No, not that appears in the record. No, he received. He did receive two counts of aggravated.
I'm not referring
correct.
To the DUI.
Yeah, no, there is no traffic ticket in the record.
Was there a traffic ticket, to your knowledge, ever issued?
Not to my knowledge. No. So just going back to the statute at issue. Again, 625, 511, 501. We know that the traffic ticket is critical because our courts have singled out the traffic ticket as the component of the statute which makes 501.6 in particular constitutional. In 1992 case, King v. Ryan, the Illinois Supreme Court held that the prior version of 501.6 was unconstitutional because at that time, any driver involved in a fatal motor vehicle accident, I see my time is up, impliedly consented. And the legislature responded to that finding that section of the statute was unconstitutional by amending the statute so that a uniform traffic ticket is required.
Justice Peterson, I have no question.
No question.
Ms. Brenner, you'll have an opportunity in a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nicolosi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Justin Nicolosi. I represent the state in this matter. As Your Honors discussed with Ms. Brenner, the state would submit that this is not an implied consent case. This is an actual consent case. And I would go even further. This is an actual consent case with an inadequate record. Justice Brennan, if you had asked me a lot of the questions that you would ask Ms. Brenner, I would have pointed to the stark inaccuracies, the inadequacies of this particular record with which to be able to answer a lot of these questions. This issue was not litigated below. Of course, counsel did not file the motion that the defendant is now wishing that counsel would have filed. Therefore, none of these issues were really flushed out below. We don't know really many details about the conversation that Trooper Quick had with the defendant in the hospital. We don't know, of course, the specifics of the warning. All we have, of course, is Trooper Quick's testimony that the defendant agreed to provide a blood sample. That's all we have. The state would submit, based on this record, we would argue that that's sufficient to establish actual consent as an exception from the warrant requirement, aside from probable cause. All we have is an officer asking a defendant a question, defendant saying yeah, and the blood sample having been taken.
How does the warning to motorist language and in coercive effect of the warning to motorists come into play with regards to tainting the consent?
Your Honor, as I did in my brief, Justice Brennan discussed Harris. In my brief, I discussed Patel. In Patel, a warning was given to the defendant who was also in the hospital. I believe the wrong warning was given there. But again, as Patel discussed and as Ms. Brenner discussed, the warnings are very, very similar. The court in Patel found that the defendant who had agreed to a law enforcement request to provide a sample, that was consensual despite the giving of requests. That wasn't a specific topic the court in Patel focused on, but based on the record and the facts in the record and the decision, the state.
But as Ms. Brenner pointed out, in Patel, there's no question there was probable cause. In this case, do you agree with Ms. Brenner that at the time Quick gave had the discussion about consent that there was no probable cause either for DUI or for a uniform traffic ticket?
Your Honor, certainly based on this record, I would agree with that. But again,
doesn't that distinguish Patel?
In a way, but again, the Patel did come around saying that they rejected the defendant's arguments about implied consent. They found that it was an actual consent case and that the defendant's consent was consensual, for lack of a better word. And again, the court Patel knew that the warning was also given there. I'm going to keep probably tethering my whole argument back to my first point that this record was inadequate. We don't have enough of a proper discussion because this was not litigated below. So we don't exactly know what happened. And I would point, as I did in my brief, the one thing I can point to that there is some evidence that there was probable cause is that Trooper Quick testified that he only gives the warning when he has reason to believe that somebody is under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And he did give the warning. So we don't know what other facts he had in his knowledge when he walked into that hospital room to give the warning and to talk to the defendant. But again, I point to the fact we just don't have enough on this record to we're really kind of grasping at straws here, kind of guessing, suggesting what might have happened, what Trooper knew, when he knew it, all this kind of stuff. And the state would submit that that collateral proceedings would be kind of a far better forum for this particular discussion.
When I look at the record, I'm not seeing the typical statutory summary suspension form filed with the clerk suggesting that law enforcement thought it should go forward with the statutory summary suspension,
sure,
which might implicitly address this question of whether Trooper Quick actually thought he had probable cause. I mean, it's not, there was no statutory summary suspension in this case, correct?
I believe you're right. I don't know for sure, but.
And there could have been if there was probable cause and the warnings were properly read.
Yes. Again, yes, you're right. And again, we're pointing to
things we don't know.
Things we don't know. I wish we knew more, but so we, transitioning slightly to kind of the second part of my brief, that let's assume for the sake of argument that counsel was deficient for not filing this particular motion, was defendant prejudiced? The state would argue the defendant was not prejudiced by the lack of the motion. And for that reason, I point to count two in this case. Defendant was actually convicted of three counts. First two were aggravated DUI. Third one was reckless homicide. But in my brief, I point to count two, which was aggravated DUI for driving under the influence. Count one was, of course, blowing over 0.8, and that was the basis for the DUI finding there. But on count two, there is blowing over 0.8 is not a prerequisite to finding guilt on count two as charged in 11-501.
But a fact finder might certainly consider two times the legal limit in trying to figure out, boy, I wonder if he was under the influence.
Sure, I understand, Your Honor, but the defendant on this appeal did not argue that the evidence in count two was insufficient. As I argued in my brief, there was sufficient evidence to support a rational trier facts finding of driving under the influence based on his admission that he had three tall beers at about 9 a.m. I believe Trooper Quick was dispatched to the scene at about 10:50 a.m., so not a whole lot of time elapsed there. There was, of course, testimony about the modules and the vehicles, and defendant was going at a very, very high rate of speed, about 96 miles an hour, 5 seconds before the crash, as the prosecutor argued below, slow to brake. According to Brian Flannery, who was the only eyewitness, the right lane was open. The defendant did not choose to swerve. The module also told the investigator that the defendant did not swerve. There are things in this record with which a jury could find that he was under the influence, regardless of whether that 0.08 or above number was provided. So the state submits that on a multiple levels, this court should affirm this decision below and reject the defendant's claims. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Woodley. Ms. Brenner.
Thank you very much.
Can I just short circuit you a little bit?
Sure.
To turn a case name into a verb, why aren't you beached here? Why? How do we possibly have enough information to address the issues that you have fairly raised?
So a couple of things. Initially, it's the state's burden to prove that consent was voluntary. The case there is People v. Anthony. It's an Illinois Supreme Court case from 2001.
Well, that certainly is true in a motion to suppress,
mm-hmm.
but this is a motion to suppress inside a ineffective assistance envelope.
Sure.
So it's a little bit more confusing in that regard.
Sure. We argue that it can be inferred from the record that Trooper Quick did not have probable cause, because if he did, he would have simply issued the uniform traffic ticket. It's clear from the warning that he was reading to himself as much as he was reading it to Mr. Moore that uniform traffic ticket was required just to give the warning, which is essentially, for lack of a better term, a threat to the recipient of the warning. One other thing as far as collateral review I would mention is that Mr. Moore received a four-year sentence because it's an aggravated DUI. It's at 85%. And he is scheduled to be paroled in December of 2026. So we would also argue that in the interest of justice, that this be considered here on direct appeal rather than recycling the case and then brought back via a post-conviction petition. Pointing really quickly to People v. Eubanks, it's a Illinois Supreme Court case that was decided in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Missouri v. McNeely, which dealt with exigent circumstances for chemical testing. And in that case, they noted critically that chemical testing may not be conducted incident to a DUI arrest the same way that a breath test can be. Instead, it requires either a warrant, which of course we don't have here, exigent circumstances, which we don't have here, because in Eubanks, the window of 3 hours was too long for law enforcement to have been concerned about the dissipation of alcohol in the blood. So certainly here, 4 hours, as counsel alluded to, between the accident and the blood draw doesn't amount to exigent circumstances. So, of course, we're left with consent, which I know is what we've attempted to drill down to right at the outset. And thank you for that, Justice Brennan. I would just reiterate that under Strickland, the prejudice prong is that a reasonable probability exists that the trial outcome would have been different had the evidence been suppressed. And we are confident that that is true because without the BAC, he could not have been convicted of the count that he was convicted of, which is explicitly about 0.08 or higher. And then just quickly responding to a couple of things that counsel argued or mentioned, we do have from the record that Mr. Moore was drinking at 9 a.m. We don't know whether he finished his three tall beers at 9 a.m. or whether he was saying he had started his beers at 9 a.m. So we're not entirely clear of the actual time frame between the time he started and the time that the accident occurred. Again, I repeat that speed itself is not indicative of a DUI. And with respect to the argument that he did not swerve before impact, we know from the crash reconstruction expert that Fred Becker stepped on the gas 100% exactly 1 second prior to impact. Mr. Moore was already braking within half a second. That's much quicker than the average driver. And it takes a second and a half. And of course, there was no opportunity to swerve. In fact, I think the reconstruction expert testified that there wouldn't have been any way to swerve. He hit the van right in the center of the passenger side. So the argument that his failure to swerve is indicative of his intoxication, I would argue failed here. And just in closing, I want to restate that we respectfully ask this court to find that Mr. Moore, his trial counsel, John Ridge, was ineffective for failing to move to suppress the blood alcohol content evidence prior to trial, and that the search of Mr. Moore's blood sample for evidence of alcohol consumption violated his constitutional rights under both the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 6 of the Illinois Constitution. Thank you so much.
I have no questions. The court thanks both sides for a spirited argument. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course.